It's Friday, April 19th, 2024, from Peachfish Productions. It's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. Normally in this place, we have a nice, clever take on the news. Sometimes it's poignant. Sometimes it's insouciant. I'm not doing that today. I'm doing a whole show, a full show, because you asked for it, on the travails at NPR, the recent critique by my former editor at times, Uri Berliner, and the blowback to that piece as being inaccurate. We have upended and torn up our entire schedule. Tomorrow on the Saturday show, we're going to play part one of an interview that you're not going to even be able to hear until Monday, the part two. Yeah, I know. I thought it was, well, I'm just listening to you guys, the fans, the gisters. I decided to go whole hog on my analysis of NPR, where I worked for 10 years. And you know, I stopped working there 10 years ago, but I've been taking notes ever since. And this is not a full data dump, but it's full enough. So stay tuned. There'll be a break in between, but we're doing a full spiel on what's going on with NPR and my plans to save a once brave employer and also provider of a pretty generous 401k. Stay tuned. This episode is brought to you by The Jordan Harbinger Show. You've heard me talk about The Jordan Harbinger Show because it's one of my favorites. He does in-depth interviews with some of the world's most fascinating minds. I can name a few: Barbara Boxer, Anderson Cooper, Michael McFaul, the Ukraine or Russia ambassador talking about Ukraine. One I recently listened to was Stanley McChrystal, the general, the former general, and he told an interesting story about revering Robert E. Lee. But then, after having a portrait of him for 40 years, he's a 63-year-old man, throwing it in the trash. Because his wife says, you know, what that picture and that man means to you, it doesn't mean to other people, and you have to understand that. And then in the interview, they got around to the point where McChrystal talked about that interview in Rolling Stone magazine that pretty much ended his career, where got to the desk of Barack Obama, and it had McChrystal saying unflattering things about the war effort, and just how he talked to his wife and how they decided not to be bitter and not to wallow in it. He could have taken some shots at the process, the reporter, or the president at that point, but he didn't. It was just an overall good interview. It was facilitated by Jordan's excellent interview style. Whether Jordan is conducting an interview or giving advice to a listener, you will find something useful that can apply to your own life in every single episode of The Jordan Harbinger Show. That could mean learning how to ask for advice the right way or discovering a little mindset tweak that changes how you see the world. Search for The Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R, like the first three letters in hard, B-I-N-G-E, as in how you'll want to catch up on all the episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And now the spiel. Hoo, Nelly. Editor Uri Berliner worked for NPR, National Public Radio, for 25 years and wrote an unauthorized critique of the organization published 10 days ago. 2 days after that, he was suspended. On Wednesday, he resigned. The thesis of the argument is, it's true, NPR has always had a liberal bent, he wrote, but during most of my tenure here, an open-minded, curious culture prevailed. We were nerdy, but not knee-jerk activists or scolding. In recent years, however, that has changed. Here's a more succinct version. The headline itself: I've been at NPR for 25 years. Here's how we lost America's trust. I don't know that NPR lost the trust of Americans who never gave a trust, who most of them didn't even know or listen to NPR. It's kind of rarefied programming. I do know empirically that NPR has lost millions and millions of listeners, more than other media has lost viewers or readers, even more than other commercial radio stations have lost listeners, though all of radio has suffered declines. My diagnosis for the lost listeners is a little bit of trust, but more about programming, story choice, story framing, willingness to service their existing listeners. And this was not a priority at NPR. The priority, the North Star, was diversification of the NPR workforce and diversification of the sources that NPR quoted. That was part of it. The This is not my supposition. This was the stated decree of then CEO John Lansing. Now, when I say this, it will be easy to open myself up to criticism, which will inevitably come, that I'm anti-diversity or I think diversity isn't necessary. No, I think diversity is not just good, not just virtuous, but absolutely necessary. And I'm not going to do the linguistic dodge of saying, but diversity of opinions. No, I'm just talking about getting more Black people and Hispanic people into a network that represents America. I would, however, like to think that there should have been a way to pull that off without having listenership suffer. If there was, NPR did not find that way. To be fair, you could also point out that at a time when NPR was diversifying, that was a time when traditional listening patterns were changing, when politics was in upheaval, when media was, of course, becoming fractured. And you can't blame all of the massive decline in NPR listenership, a 30% drop over the last 5 years or so, to the fact that the North Star was something other than pleasing the audience. Maybe you can't blame most of it on that being NPR's North Star. But the idea that if your priority is something other than the listeners, and as you're executing this priority other than listeners, if then listeners fall away in huge numbers, I would consider the possibility that the decline might have had something to do with the deprioritization of the audience. I reject that. And NPR veteran Jeremy Hobson, when he talked to me a few months ago, also rejected that.
The soon-to-be former CEO of NPR said that the North Star for him is diversity, equity, and inclusion. And I think the North Star of any news operation needs to be truth and trust. And like that is, I think that there are more people now that feel that that is what needs to be the North Star of news organizations. Because if you don't have that, you're going to lose your whole audience.
Jeremy is now hosting a public radio program called The Middle, just kind of a throwback to an older NPR ethos. Moderation, curiosity, a desire to entertain views that might not be seen as fitting exactly within a social justice framework. Now, Uri's major critique was on the left-right axis. He said that NPR had gone too far left, citing stories about Hunter Biden's laptop, the Mueller report, and the origins of COVID-19. I think there's validity there. I think NPR reporters and producers began talking past the actual NPR audience for an imagined NPR audience that was more in agreement with social justice issues, issues like policing, racial disparities, and the very nature of how we know what we know. Let's take the issue of disparities, and let's focus now on the disparities in the death rate from COVID. This wasn't an Uri's piece. This is my premise. So for the first few years of the pandemic, we were told, because it was true, that Black and Hispanic people were more likely to die of COVID. But then we stopped being told that. And the reason is that white people became not just the largest number of deaths from COVID, but disproportionately so. There was still a disparity, but it was the white people who were suffering. According to the CDC today, or actually March 31st is the last date they have stats for, 694,000 or 67% of all COVID deaths are of whites, 161,000 African Americans, 174,000 Hispanics. Now, the percentage of Hispanics is quite a bit lower than they are in the overall percent of the population. African Americans about the same. White Americans are higher. The Washington Post broke this story in 2022, or I should say they probably first noted it because the CDC and universities, who were talking a lot about disparities when it was Black and brown people who were getting killed, stopped talking about it quite so much. I'm not alleging a cover-up. I'm just saying that you follow what your interests are when reporting the news. So it was the Washington Post who pointed this out, to their credit, that COVID was killing white people more. And it was NPR's Michelle Martin, one of the very best journalists at the network, who had them on to talk about it.
At the beginning of the COVID pandemic, everyone from community leaders to civil rights groups to Trump's Surgeon General warned that the virus was hitting some people harder than others. Racial disparities were particularly striking, with Black people, especially in cities, dying at several times the rate of white people. But as the pandemic has gone on, that trend has reversed.
So NPR did not totally ignore the fact that over the course of the pandemic, a white American has been more likely to die of COVID than a Black or Hispanic American. But other than that Michelle Martin interview, I couldn't find a single reference on NPR to that fact. And before the interview, when the numbers first began to emerge of a disparity in the direction of Black and Latino people being the victims, there were dozens and dozens of reports. Did NPR not care if it was more white people dying? Did they not care? If the reason why more white people dying was that they were Republicans who eschewed vaccination and protection? I don't actually think it's it. I think they literally didn't perceive of it as a story. A disparity is a story when it is black and brown people who are suffering that disparity. Michelle Martin thought that it was a story in 2022, but a few months after her interview, NPR was back to just misstating which group was getting the worst of the COVID pandemic. Here's a book review from January 23. No Justice, No Peace aims in part to answer these questions. The book features more than 100 protest photographs made between 2014 and 2022, and almost alongside texts by emerging and established writers spanning the fields of activism, poetry, photography, law, academia, and more. Poet Wallace Lane reflects on racial health disparities, which became pronounced during the COVID-19 pandemic. Quote, the same government who lynched us, it's no coincidence, pumped us and destroyed us with poisons and carcinogens. Okay, it's a book review. That's what the guy wrote in the book. There was nothing in the book review, however, to explain to the NPR audience that what the poet was writing about wasn't the case. Here's a straightforward news story, August 2023. Those on the ground in North Carolina's most vulnerable communities, including Cohen's admirers, tell another story about living with the downside of the state's emergency response. These include advocates for groups that were disproportionately harmed during the public health crisis, including minority and immigrant communities, people with disabilities, and families of nursing home residents. That last one is still true. The minority community's part is not. Here's Tanya Mosley, one of the new hosts of Fresh Air, interviewing the author of Legacy, A Black Physician Reckons with Racism in Media.
Just to put this into perspective, we weren't having this discussion about the disproportionate impact of COVID on communities of color. You were just starting to come into this.
Exactly. I mean, you know, we had been talking about racial health inequities in general. You know, for years, we've been talking about the Black maternal mortality crisis. But in terms of COVID's impact on Black communities, that conversation had not started yet.
That was an important moment for you. It helped you reorient and understand, as you put it, the longstanding systemic inequities that ensure Black Americans have far worse health outcomes than any other group in the country.
Now, none of those general misstatements in the directions of disparity are lies. They're not really inaccurate, I think, if you parse hard enough. Mosley was right. Her guest did alert the public to the truth about racial disparities back then, but Mosley didn't provide the information about the state of things as her listeners were hearing that interview. I don't have smoking guns where NPR said things wrong because they actually have editors that know the truth. But I do have the fact that when it was Black and brown communities who were suffering, the ratio of those kind of reports to the one report where it said that there were white people who were dying more was something like 100-1. NPR listeners, and I would also say most consumers of mass media, certainly have the impression that COVID has been disproportionately deadly for the exact opposite communities that it's been deadly for. And I'll concede there are a lot of economic reasons why that was true for Black and brown people in the beginning of the pandemic, and more social reasons why it's now true for white people, why they've disproportionately died, also age factors in. But my thesis is that a story with a victim group, that is Black and brown, plays into the social justice priors of the journalists and NPR and many other mainstream news sources in a way that the actual current facts about the pandemic do not. That's why you hear less about it. I could cite many other examples. Let's talk about policing for a second. Uri, who was an editor of mine for many years, he wrote about the topics he wrote about to illustrate his point that NPR was overly beholden to the precepts popular on the left and was hostile to countervailing evidence or theories that ran against this mindset. So we'll get to policing in a second. Here I'd like to talk about the Mueller investigation. Berliner did write that the Mueller report found no credible evidence of collusion. Not the best phrase. It was assailed by critics within and without NPR as inaccurate. I would say that the best thing you could say about Mueller was that he failed to uncover acts that could be charged as a conspiracy. This was, I think, the best point of those criticizing Uri, and it's not a factual error. It really is the only solid point of many of those assailing Berliner's articles. I saw it being described as inaccurate and error-filled so often, and I tried to find the errors, and I don't think they're there. You can disagree with his argument. You can disagree with the strength of his points. But is it accurate to say it's inaccurate? 50 NPR journalists who, I don't know, their names aren't public, I have no idea to evaluate their claims, wrote an open letter to NPR management asking management to call out, quote, the pieces of factual inaccuracies and elisions. And then a staffer from the Democratic Congressman Don Beyer put together a thread attempting to poke holes in Berliner's thesis, which again was that NPR become overly aligned with the Democratic Party. I found out about this thread when NPR critic, meaning he works for NPR, he's a critic, TV critic, and a journalist, Eric Deggans, he on Twitter pointed to this thread and said it was excellent to read. So the guy's name was Aaron, still is, Aaron Fritschner. He attempted to paint Berliner as lying when Uri Berliner wrote that NPR wouldn't cover Hunter Biden's laptop when it first surfaced. Fritschner writes, but that's not true. NPR covered the story at the time and explained why they were being cautious. Come on, Fritschner. NPR's coverage was only of why it wasn't offering coverage. And this was an understandable decision, but who's lying when they say that NPR did cover the Hunter Biden laptop? I mean, NPR quoted their managing editor for news, top guy at the time, saying, quote, we don't want to waste our time on stories that are not really stories, and we don't want to waste the listener and reader's time on stories that are just pure distractions. I was tweeting with a former NPR colleague of mine, and I reminded this person of that tweet, and they responded, LOL, that's embarrassing as fuck. Indeed it is. And I'll be fair, there's more to the decision than that one quote. I read Terrence Samuel's statements on this. They thought it out. They worked really hard. They were trying to do the best by the information that was known at the time. Great. I get it. They made a mistake. But that's the point. They made a mistake. The laptop was Hunter Biden's. He does not deny it. The FBI confirms it. Other media confirmed it. CBS did an analysis. The Washington Post did an analysis. Uri in his piece quotes the Washington Post analysis. Then Fritschner, this Democratic staffer who's been given way too much credit as an arbiter in all this, takes Uri's line that the essential facts of the Post reporting about the laptop were confirmed and the emails verified and says, nah, that wasn't true. He says the Washington Post story says just the opposite. In fact, it supports NPR's 2020 decision. Here's the headline of the Washington Post story that apparently says the opposite, that the emails were verified. Headline, here's how the Post analyzed Hunter Biden's laptop. Subhead, two experts confirm the veracity of thousands of emails, but say a thorough examination was stymied by missing data. Is that the opposite of confirmation? That's confirmation. Fritschner tries to hoodwink people who read his tweet. It worked in some cases, even with NPR employees, by highlighting the parts of the Washington Post story where they disclosed that some parts of the laptop couldn't be electronically verified. He leaves out, but lots could. Again, I have to say again, Hunter Biden's legal team confirms it was his laptop. NPR screwed up. A lot of other media screwed up too. Okay, everyone screwed up. I understand why they screwed up. But stop lying to us with fictions about the laptop and saying Uri lied to us when he didn't. Overall, it's shameful, stupid stuff. Don't take my word. Don't take CBS's words. Don't take the Washington Post words. Don't take Hunter Biden's legal team's words. Take the word of NPR Scott Simon from 2 years ago.
There's fresh scrutiny on Hunter Biden, the president's son, as he is under investigation. Part of that investigation appears to center on emails that showed up on a notorious laptop that was publicized before the 2020 election and then dismissed by much of the news media. Many of these emails have now been authenticated.
NPR has done subsequent reporting confirming the laptop was real, by the way, and examining how all of its verification played out. But Uri's point was right. NPR got it wrong and then left it alone. And it's not that it never corrected. It's understandable it's a mistake. But it was a mistake, and it didn't serve listeners. And to this day, I went on a Reddit page where people from NPR discuss NPR. They were discussing the quote-unquote errors in Uri Berliner's story. And so many, the vast majority of them, when writing about the laptop, still believe it was Russian disinformation. It was a hoax. Okay, so that's some guy you never heard of named Aaron Fritschner. Who cares, right? Well, it's just that he was being cited, or his tweet thread was being prominently cited as a rebuke in so many quarters to Uri's piece. After a break, we will talk about the criticisms of a guy that you have heard of and who you should care about, Steve Inskeep. Join me as Mike loses more friends. Part two in a moment. We're back discussing the critiques of NPR, both valid and perhaps debunked, which brings me to a very credible source who is assailing Berliner's accuracy. It is a quite accurate journalist, as accurate a journalist as NPR has, Steve Inskeep. I sit under a framed picture of Steve Inskeep. Granted, it's a cartoon, but I have a lot of cartoons of people I worked with when I was with NPR, people I loved, people who guided me in the world of journalism, who I still look up to, friends, mentors. There's Steve among the 12 of them. And Steve writes in a Substack post about a claim in Berliner's essay that the party registration of NPR staffers who live in Washington, D.C. was that Democrats were 87 and Republicans were zero. Now, Inskeep never says that this was inaccurate, but after saying, quote, my colleague's article was filled with errors and omissions, he jumps to this to illustrate that point, an anecdote about his speaking before a crowd that was assembled to see him interviewed about his book, quote, I am a prominent member of the newsroom in Washington. If Uri told the truth, then I could only be registered as a Democrat. I held up a screenshot of my voter registration showing I am registered with, quote, no party. Some in the crowd gasped. Uri had misled them. Huh? He had? He never said, nor was it implied, that everyone has to register for a party. Everyone who is registered in the United States, I think, knows there's no requirement to do so. Some states, some cities, if it's DC, have different designations indicating independent or no party or no affiliation. I understand why Steve, who is the epitome of fairness, something we used to call 15 or 20 years ago, objectivity, I get why he would hate if he thought that someone incorrectly inferred that he must be a Democrat from that stat. But I gotta say, there was nothing in Uri's piece to lead anyone to incorrectly conclude that. I always say there are inaccuracies, there are lies of omissions, and then there's this whole other category where if I told you one fact about what you just read, would it change your opinion of the overall veracity? All right, what if I told you, Uri says that the registration in DC is 87 Democrats to zero Republicans. But what if I told you that some people aren't registered to either party? You might say, yeah, so what? Of course, that's what I assumed. I mean, Steve's overall point would have been rebutted had Uri started the paragraph. Of those who are registered to a party, the breakdown is 87 Dems, zero Republicans. Would the article have been improved had he done that? I guess you could always add dozens of qualifiers, and to be sure, it generally detracts from the trust of an argument, should be avoided unless it's not explicitly unfair to leave it out. Then Steve makes a point about the use of the word Latinx, how it's declining at NPR. Fair, okay, but it's not important, I don't think. It's not an error. Eric Wemple, who's a media critic in the Washington Post, also wrote a pretty good column taking issue with some of Uri's points, but they all fall in the category of NPR was hardly the worst offender, or there are better examples of NPR's failings than the one that Uri cites. Alicia Montgomery, NPR veteran writing for a website where I used to work, also criticizes Uri's prescriptions, but not his facts. And she does concede that NPR went, quote, full white guilt after George Floyd's murder. I heard that. I remember listening. Many listeners heard that. I could do a full show on the Jacob Blake shooting in Kenosha, which was actually, we know now, the story of an armed man with a warrant for sexual assault trying to get into a car he did not own with three children under nine inside, above the objections of the child's mother, who called police to tell him keep him out of the car. He frequently crashes cars, including having done so just a few days prior. All right, that was the truth of the story. Most of the media did not portray that as the truth. The story that NPR, and again, there were worse actors in the media, the story that NPR put forward was very different, with the fact that Jacob Blake was armed either being dismissed or downplayed as beside the point, or maybe concocted as a post hoc justification by the police for a bad shooting.
I think many people read the press release saying that there was a knife as an effort by the Justice Department to justify the police shooting. Is that what that was?
NPR host Ari Shapiro there continued to grill his guest, the Wisconsin Attorney General, whose only point was we have to wait until all the evidence comes in, a recommendation that I wish NPR and the Kenosha community would have adhered to. But Shapiro takes for granted that the officer, who was ultimately cleared criminally, never even sued civilly, that he was part of the problem.
I think many people watching the video would reach the conclusion that there are systemic problems, that the culture is broken, that the individual officer here may be the problem, but is not the extent of the problem.
It was a time when there were true horrors abounding. George Floyd was murdered. Breonna Taylor was killed in her hallway for no justifiable reason. And that gave way to, in the media and on the streets, fervor. The fervor was sometimes righteous, and sometimes it was just fervid. There's one critique of Berliner that I think is valid. It was articulated by NPR reporter Danielle Kurtzleben. Quote, if you violate everyone's trust by going to another outlet and shitting on your colleagues while doing a bad job journalistically, for that matter, I don't know how you do your job now. Okay, that I get. Uri's role as an editor certainly would have been made harder by his essay had he stayed. Of course, there are many cases of whistleblowers who call into question the culture in which they're operating, who find it hard to come back and successfully once again operate in that culture. I'm thinking of the women who exposed Tailhook, the NYPD's Frank Serpico got shot at. But there have been other examples of NPR journalists publicly shitting on the institution and doing just fine. It really depends on if your colleagues agree with you or even feel like they can rebut the critique. I'm thinking of a time in June of 2020 where a producer for the call-in show 1A, which is produced by WAMU and distributed by NPR, a person named Morgan Givens, he criticized public Trump on Twitter in a manner that violated his station's protocols. So he was given a talking to. He then proceeded to criticize his bosses for chastising him. He did this all very publicly on Twitter, and here's his punishment. He was invited to be a guest on his own program alongside guest Nicole Hannah-Jones and the ombudsman for PBS. He was given the floor, quite a bit of floor. I'm going to play a long answer that he gave. The name of the show is When Journalists Say They're Objective, What Does That Even Mean? Here, when asked, why'd you tweet that? Here's what he said.
I tweeted that, and I also tweeted there is a white supremacist fascist in the White House. And when you have the understanding of what white supremacy is and how it functions as a system, you cannot help but see that truth. And the problem that I am seeing, you know, when people point at me and say, how can you say that? I'm looking at them like, how do you not have the knowledge of the institution in which you work so that you cannot see it? How do you not have the historical awareness and the subjectivity and everything and the knowledge that makes it so you can actually remove yourself as much as possible intellectually from the white supremacist system in which we all function to actually name it? And the reason that that caused such a furor, I'm guessing, in the editorial building or, you know, in editorial staff meetings or whatever the case may be, is because the inability to call out fascism is directly linked to journalists' inability to call out white supremacy in the United States because the two are so inextricably tied. And so I stand by what I said because it's the truth. And it's the truth cannot be held hostage or captive for those who do not know it yet and for those who have not done the reading yet and for those who do not understand that it is a constant life battle to unlearn what this white supremacist capitalist patriarchal system has taught us. And so unlearning that means that we have to also unmask the things that make it so we cannot call the truth the truth. That means we have to point to the guidelines that say black journalists need to be silent in the face of what they know to be true and then also acknowledge that these guidelines are based in the white supremacist idea of objectivity.
The host and the other guests all agreed with him. And I think for a while, much of NPR agreed. Many still do. The new president seems to more or less agree. Those who disagree, and they're out there, feel they better not say so. It's much safer to keep your head down or cavil about errors of fact that are in fact not errors when someone else points it out publicly. NPR deserves a lot of critique. All of the media does. And the thing that turns it around for them won't be a now jettisoned former insider. It's good to have critiques. It's good to critique critiques when it's valid to do so. The thing that does turn it around, if it can be turned around, will be the experience of listeners and the size of the audience, their willingness to contribute, and their love and trust in NPR. If NPR and public radio cannot begin appealing to a lot more people, their ambitions and potency will be forever diminished. And the solution, I say, is right there in the middle of NPR, meaning the P, the public. They're going to tell them if they're correcting problems, problems acknowledged, sometimes problems denied. But I also mean something else by the solution being in the middle of NPR. I believe, to paraphrase a now disfavored, somewhat centrist Democrat, that there's nothing wrong with NPR that can't be fixed by what's right with NPR. I just hope NPR has the discernment to realize which is which. And that's it for today's show. Staying up way too late on a Friday, Corey Wara, the producer, Joel Patterson, the senior producer. They're the Quaint Mallards. Construction advice from Michelle Pesca, who oversees special projects and concrete installation for Peachfish Productions. To advertise, go to advertisecast.com/thegist. Umpru, gpru, dupru, and thanks for listening.